BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. I'm joined by a crack all-female team of detectives to investigate the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes of Victorian murderesses. Please be aware that this episode contains material you might find distressing. Now, can you imagine living on the edge of poverty in overcrowded housing in inner city Victorian London? And then can you imagine losing six of your 12 children in infancy? And now, on top of that, you're losing your sight and you're falling sick as well. What might you be driven to do?
I was quite destitute. My husband has himself been taken ill, and I've been told by the parish doctor that I should not live long, and I thought it better to do what I did.
The legal question is not whether such persons are the victims of a homicidal frenzy of the nature of madness, but whether they can be so influenced by the dread of punishment, of the gallows, as to be deterred from the actual murderous deed.
6 or 7 years ago, she had 3 children at one birth who died. After that, I observed an alteration in her mind, a sort of childishness, and she would cry a very great deal. She always seemed so oppressed in her spirits.
I'm Lucy Worsley, and this is Lady Killers, where crime meets history with a twist. I'm taking a look, well, a feminist look, actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses from Victorian Britain, North America, and beyond. We're going to hear their words, we're going to hear their voices from the past, and we're going to ask what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things. And how different is it for women today? Today's lady killer is Esther Lack, driven by desperation, poverty, and illness to commit 3 truly horrifying murders. I went to Bankside in London to meet Rosalind Crone, senior lecturer in history at the Open University and our in-house historian, to find out what it would have been like in the 1860s when Esther and her family were living here. So, Ros, we're in a place that many, many people will know. We can see St. Paul's Cathedral. We have the Globe Theatre behind us. There's the Tate Modern. There's a million tourists swirling around us. So now it's a really classy, touristy part of town. But what would it have been like here in 1865? It was industrial, wasn't it?
Yeah, in 1865, it was a bit of a combination of wharves and warehousing along here. And then behind us, some more residential area. And then behind that again, industry. Well, you wouldn't have seen too much of the river because you would have had a lot of warehousing in front here. Also heavier industry, so ironworks and boiler works as well behind here. So if you can imagine the heat and the smells and the kind of degradation of the area because of all that industry and the people who worked in those industries needing to live within close proximity as well.
We're round the back of the Globe Theatre now. We're actually in Skin Market Place.
Yes. The Lacks lived at number 10. It looks rather different today, with black gates that you can't go through, and it's basically the backyard of the Globe Theatre and the Tate Modern. So Skin Market Place was basically a skin market. Sheepskins were sold there to support the leather trade.
So what would it have been like down here in 1865?
Would have been fairly unpleasant. So if you think of Skin Market Place as being lots of little alleys with more buildings coming off, more housing.
So here's a journalist reporting on the Lack case. He says that people are unprepared to witness such a scene of misery at Skin Market Place and the human burrows near it. He says that surrounding factories and manure depots made the air almost insupportable. He's talking here about heaps of filth in the street over which squalid and almost naked children played in front of their dens of homes, and that it's a pestilence-breeding locality. Now,
all of that sounds very squalid, but I'm troubled by the way he makes it sound like the children are animals and that they live in dens instead of homes.
That's always a tension, isn't it? 19th century reformers, 19th century journalists, social commentators, they always big things up a bit because they are so keen to get the public on side in pressing for reform. But at the heart, you're absolutely right. These are living human beings, and these sorts of accounts tend to dehumanise them. Mm. So you always have to cut through that. A good way of cutting through that is looking at the census and seeing what people actually lived in the neighbourhood.
So who was living here? Who were the Lacks neighbours?
The neighbours of the Lacks included, for example, a tailor with his seamstress wife. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't sound too bad. Also a fisherman or underwaterman.
Yeah.
With a laundress and a bricklayer at number 9.
There's a whole community of busy, industrious people just about making a living.
Yeah, exactly. These are people. These were real people who lived there.
What was it like to go through the door of number 10 then to where the Lacks actually lived?
So if we take a look at the family, we've got John Lack, head of the household. He was acting as a night watchman.
Yes.
So probably for a warehouse.
Yes.
Yep. And he also had another job as a knocker-upper.
A knocker-upper. Now, that sounds like he was getting ladies pregnant, but it doesn't mean that.
It's basically an alarm clock system.
A human alarm clock.
So you go and wake people up because factories work odd hours.
Yeah.
So people get up at strange hours in the 19th century.
How many people in total were in the Lack family?
Nine. So in 1865, we had John and Esther with 5 of their children living with them, a son-in-law and a grandchild.
That's a lot of Lacks.
And those 9 people living in 3 rooms in basically a rundown tenement, each of the rooms being about 9 foot square with a tiny little court out the back, which is probably about 3 or 4 foot.
So it was in the very small hours of the morning of the 22nd of August, 1865, that John Lack came home from his shift as a night watchman to this tiny, cramped little house in Skin Market Place to discover that something was horribly wrong.
Mate, is that you?
Yeah, all right.
I have done it. I have killed them at last.
Esther has cut the throats of their 3 youngest children while they slept. Christopher was 10, Eliza 6, and little Esther was 2. There's blood everywhere. When Police Constable Henry Pope arrives on the scene shortly afterwards, he finds Esther still standing by the bedroom mantelpiece, picking dried blood off her hands. She's pretty calm, as she says.
I know perfectly well what I am about. I murdered the children. I woke up about 3 o'clock and got up. I then went downstairs and got the razor from the cupboard in the kitchen. I came upstairs again and first cut the throat of Christopher. Then I went to the bed and cut the throat of Eliza and then cut the throat of the baby. It took no more than 3 minutes. After I had done it, I took up the body of the baby and kissed it.
To help me understand this case and explore the issues it still raises, I'm joined by Dr. Gwen Adshead. She's a leading forensic psychiatrist and psychotherapist who has a particular interest in mothers who harm their children. Now, Gwen, since the time of Greek tragedy, really, infanticide has been seen as a crime against nature somehow, hasn't it?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think there's something about mothers and children together which is the epitome of something fecund and creative. So that when a mother hurts her child, attempts to kill her child, it feels like it's something unnatural there.
How common is it? Very rare, I imagine.
For mothers to kill their children, yes, very unusual. But I think what's interesting about this is that when children are killed, they are generally killed by their parents.
Really?
And yes. And in fact, statistically, the people who are most at risk of being killed each year are babies under a year old. So there's something here about the disturbance of the relationship between a mother and a child, which looks as though it might be quite important to what happens when a child is killed by their mother.
I want to find out what drove Esther to kill her three youngest children in cold blood. She appears the next morning in the local magistrate's court, charged with murder. She's in very poor health. She's almost blind. She has this ulcerated leg that means she can hardly walk. The Times newspaper says that she's 42, but she looks about 60.
Do you wish to speak?
I have only this to say. I was quite destitute, and my little girl was quite blind. My husband has himself been taken ill, and I fretted very much because I had to go to the hospital. And I have been told by the parish doctor that I should not live long. And I thought it better to do what I did, because I thought my children would be safer to be in heaven than starving about the streets.
Esther's taken to Horsemonger Lane Jail and committed for trial at the Central Criminal Court, the Old Bailey. For Esther, she sees these as mercy killings. Gwen, what do you think about that?
I think that's interestingly very common. In a study that was published about 20 years ago of a large group of women who'd all killed their children, there was a little subgroup who had killed their children because for what they called altruistic reasons or mercy killings, where they thought their children would be better off dead. And I think it's intriguing to me that Esther Lack was so clear about this and that she had a very clear understanding of why she was doing it.
It seems striking to me as well that she's so matter-of-fact and almost emotionless about it. Is that something that you've experienced?
Yes, I think so. I think in order to gear yourself up to kill somebody that you love, you usually have to try and get into a kind of composed state of mind in order to do it. And it's a bit like suicide in that way. There's a kind of determination that once your mind is made up, then you're going to do it. But I think people who kill in this context often then seem quite detached to other people. And they're often in a kind of state where they are a bit emotionally detached because it's the only way to make it possible to actually carry it out.
Now, earlier in the 19th century, women were sometimes executed for killing their children. But by the 1860s, the law and public opinion had moved on. Lots of women who were accused of this crime were now submitting pleas to the courts of insanity. Now, it might not surprise you at all to learn that this led to certain gentlemen of the press saying that women like Esther were literally getting away with murder.
Pall Mall Gazette, 25th of August, 1865. The point which it is so important to press on public attention is this, that the legal question is not whether such persons as Esther Lack are the victims of a homicidal frenzy of the nature of madness, but whether they can be so influenced by the dread of punishment as to be deterred from the actual murderous deed. In the common interest, it is our aim to haunt their poor unhappy minds with hideous thoughts of the gallows or some other terrible vision, which will rise before their imaginations and crush the bloody impulses of disease.
Esther goes on trial at the Old Bailey on the 18th of September 1865, and as expected, she pleads insanity. Now, here's something really intriguing. Her lawyer brings up the fact that Esther had finished breastfeeding her youngest child just 2 weeks before the murders. He calls as a witness Dr. Hibbard. This is the local parish doctor in Bankside, and asks him an interesting question.
Dr. Hibbard, does not the fact of the cessation of giving the lacteal secretion to a child sometimes cause functional derangement?
Certainly it does. That functional derangement occasionally having a direct influence on the brain. The consequence is sometimes a mental derangement. as it would weaken the bodily constitution, so it would affect the nervous system.
So that doctor is saying that ending breastfeeding is going to sometimes cause a mental derangement. It's going to have a direct influence on Esther's mental state. That's curious. I asked our resident historian, Ros Crone, to explain.
So the vulnerability of pregnant and new mothers, and including breastfeeding mothers, to mental disorders had been recognised before the 19th century. But from about the 1820s, medical professionals began to pay more attention and to label these. And one that attracted particular attention was puerperal insanity. Now, this was more than just baby blues or depression. This was used for women who were severely depressed and violent. And by the 1850s and 1860s, it was regularly invoked in cases of infanticide. Historians such as Hilary Marland and others have suggested puerperal insanity belonged very much to the 19th century. It derived from the challenge of women's lives, marriage, childbearing, living conditions. It was identified and received so much attention because of the feminine ideals so vigorously promoted by the Victorians. Domesticity, passivity, women as nurturers. Puerperal insanity arose from women's reproductive functions and their weakness.
So it's great to have Gwen here so I can ask her more questions. Gwen, it seems to make sense to me that in an age of domesticity and the elevation of motherhood, if mothers screw up, then you need a new name for what they're doing wrong. Does it still exist today?
Well, yes and no. There are a couple of issues that are important to think about in this context. One is that motherhood is always an idealized state. And so when women get that wrong, there needs to be an explanation for it. And mental illness seems like a good explanation for it. And particularly that kind of mental illness where it seems that women don't really know what they're doing. And that seems to explain particularly their violence to children, which is so shocking. But I think the other thing that's complicated is that we do know that women's mental health does sometimes deteriorate, both in the run-up to having a child and in the weeks and months afterwards. So there really are, I think, disturbances of mental state that affect women that can also affect their relationships with their babies.
So there's two things going on here. There's society's idea of what insanity might be, which is one thing. But then there's actual scientifically defined mental illness, which is a gendered thing. Is that right?
One of the ways that we like to think about disorders in mental health now is with a kind of biological and a social and a psychological perspective, the biopsychosocial model. There's a social aspect of that, which is how people treat you when you're pregnant and how your role in your family and your social life changes when you become a mother. And then there's what happens to you psychologically, the transition into this role of motherhood, which, if it fits for you, is great. But for some women, it becomes a painful process. So there's a biopsychosocial approach in which we do take women's mental health very seriously before the birth of their children and after.
So Gwen, we've got various doctors in the 19th century putting names on these new disorders. Is the 19th century the time that your profession, psychiatry, starts to get invented?
Yes, it kind of does. The word psychiatrist emerges in Germany in the 19th century, and the idea of medical doctors of the mind really gets going. And what is interesting is their appearance in the criminal courts, where people use the idea of mental disorder to explain violence, and particularly violence that's shocking or disturbing or unnatural in some way.
Well, let's see how this plays out for Esther Lack. Esther barely speaks at her trial, but it's really touching just how many female relatives and friends come forward to speak for her. We get a picture of a desperate woman in very poor health who'd given birth to 12 children over 20 years and lost six of them.
In 1850, she had twins, and 6 or 7 years ago, she had three children at one birth who died. After that, I observed an alteration in her mind, a sort of childishness, and she would cry a very great deal. She always seemed so oppressed in her spirits. She would sit and not move or speak to anyone.
If I went to see her, she would burst out crying. She's complained very much of her head, but she always behaved with uniform kindness and affection to her children.
Within the last 2 or 3 months, she has had fits. She frequently fell down 2 or 3 times in a day. The Sunday morning was the last. She was choking, with froth coming out of her mouth and nose.
She was always an industrious woman, and a kind and affectionate mother and wife.
The jury finds Esther not guilty on the grounds of insanity. She's ordered to be detained until Her Majesty's pleasure is known. Gwen, this to me, it seems quite a merciful verdict, given assumptions you might make about the dark old Victorian days.
Well, I think it's important for us to understand that the criminal process is often about dealing with people and finding a way out. And I think this is a situation where there was a lot of sympathy for Esther Lack. And the insanity defence is a way for people to be looked after and contained. But also it's acknowledged that they weren't carrying out an offence that was perhaps as cruel as some other kinds of murders. So in a way, the insanity defence gives a court a way out for people who seem to deserve mercy.
It's a little surprising to me that the court took into account her background and her health and the good character that she'd been given by her neighbours. That seems quite a modern approach to me.
Well, I think that one of the things that makes a big difference in this case is the existence of capital punishment. So when you've got a case where a woman could be killed for killing her own children, I think courts look very carefully at the backgrounds of the perpetrators. And when a powerful case is made that this woman has not killed her children out of malice, then I think the courts look to the insanity defence to give them a way out.
Isn't that fascinating?
This person has done a terrible thing, but perhaps did not have that kind of evil or cruel intent that we want to punish.
I'm seeing a lot of continuity, actually, between the way that Esther Lack was treated and the sort of work that you're doing today.
I think there is continuity. I think what we're able to add now is an understanding of this psychosocial narrative with a kind of biological one. I think perhaps when women are pregnant, when women are mothers, we listen to them, we ask them more questions than we did, and we make sure that their views get integrated into their care.
Now, because the Bethlehem Hospital in London is full up, Esther gets sent to the asylum in Salisbury called Fisherton House. Back in Bankside, where the remaining members of Esther's family went on living without her, I talked to Ros Crone about the end of Esther's sad story.
So here we are in Skin Market Place. We know that this is not a pleasant environment. It's crowded, it's smelly, it's urban. Do you think that Esther was almost in better conditions at Fisherton House?
Actually, yes, Lucy, I do think so. In 1865, when she arrived there, I think it might surprise you to hear what Fisherton House Asylum was actually like. Looking at pictures of the place, it was quite beautiful. Yeah, that main house was a manor house. The gardens were lovely. Yeah, the brochures that survived in the institution later in the century really, really show that. There was much made of getting patients out into the fresh air and working on the farm as part of their treatment. And the use of kind of medical restraints had been prohibited by this time.
Do you mean straight jackets?
Yeah. They wanted other ways to kind of deal with them. And,
this is
and
sounding
to help
like
them.
Quite an enlightened institution. And there is this visit by a journalist from the Cornhill magazine.
Yeah, that's right. In October 1864, a journalist visited. So right before Esther Lack goes there. And he provides quite an interesting description. He's given a tour by the lead doctor and he meets some of the criminally insane females.
I'm rather taken by his description he includes of a musical evening that they have with music and dancing. And someone points out that there were 30 murderers in the audience at the concert.
Yes, that's right. There's been some very interesting work by historians, for example, who look at the kind of the domestic trappings that are brought into these sorts of institutions, including asylums, that they tried to make it quite comfortable for inmates as part of their moral therapy, as well as the recovery of their health. It was all bound up together. Women were sent to asylums to protect their children, but also to get better.
So our cliched view that the Victorian asylum is a terrible place, lock them up, throw away the key, there's more to it than that, isn't there?
It's way more complicated than that.
So in a place like this, there is the possibility, at least, of recovery, isn't there?
Yes. Female patients who committed infanticide did recover in these institutions. Some went home to their families, but some did not.
Now, sadly, Esther
wasn't one of those who recovered, was she?
No, unfortunately, Esther died 2 months after she was admitted to the asylum.
Gwen, do you have any insight into what you think might have been going on with Esther?
There are a number of interesting clues, I think, based on what people have said about her. It sounds to me as though she definitely might have been depressed, and that might have got worse through bereavement, through loss of children. But I note that her doctor said that she had a terminal illness and that she was going to die. She developed blindness, which is a very unusual symptom without something going on, probably in the optical cortex. And then she developed headaches and fits. And blindness, headaches and fits could well be signs and symptoms of a brain tumour. And I also wonder whether she might have suffered from the kind of disturbances of blood pressure that sometimes go with childbirth. So I wonder really in a way whether she's someone who's a testimony to the lack of a proper medical history, the joined up thinking that we now take for granted in medicine, that we can get people's histories of what they suffered from in the past and put them together. So I do find myself wondering whether she might have died of a brain tumour.
If that were the case, if she had this feeling that she was going to die, you can see a glimmer of understanding as to why she might think her children would be in a better place in heaven.
Her sense of hopelessness and helplessness might distort her thinking to the point that she might think that there was nobody to look after them and they would be better off in heaven.
Poor Esther. Finally, Gwen, how do you feel about Esther's really tragic story? Do you think it shows that the Victorians were like us, or were they living in a different country?
I think we have more in common than we have differences. I think then, as now, there is a wish to try and understand terrible offences and perhaps to try and offer care for people who've done terrible things and an opportunity to change their minds for the better.
Well, I've just had a preconception overturned. I thought that Victorian society was judgmental to the hilt. Not always. Well, thank you ever so much to Gwen Adsett and Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Killers, a case that started with a dismembered torso in a Pennsylvania pond and ended with an African-American woman taking on the law with surprising consequences. Meet Hannah Mary Tabbs, a woman who was very good at being very bad. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Jane Greenwood. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The music's composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Jade Adams, and in Welcome to the Neighbourhood, I take a peek at the nation's community apps and message boards for some comedy eavesdropping.
Does anyone know who's parked on our drive?
I got hit by a potato on the high street earlier.
Could you please have some decency and close the curtains if you're having sex?
Each episode, I'll be joined in my online curtain twitching by a different guest, including James Acaster.
You don't need to put out a thing to the local community. You can just go straight to the police.
Sarah Keyworth.
I highly doubt she's read the highway code.
And Helen Bauer.
They're inciting a riot in three sentences.
Welcome to the Neighbourhood with me, Jade Adams, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.